you have to zoom in, look closely. It's this, what might seem like a dark entity at the beginning. Dark, rich, brown. It's like a really spongy, flaky, crumbly cake. Or cookie. Obatala shaped us from clay, imperfect and diverse, yet filled with the breath of the divine. The Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The gods molded Enkidu, the wild man, Unkulunkulu, bring balance to the emerged from the reed, Tane Mahuta formed Hine Huon, the Tiku molded us, teaching us how to live in harmony with the land. In origin stories from cultures and religions around the world, divine beings shaped us from clay and earth, breathing life into us. Soil is more than dirt. It nourishes and sustains us, and it's what we will return to and become again. At our feet is a hidden world full of life. Maybe soil holds the key to our future. My name is Shanice Aretha. I'm an artist and a resident here at Somerset House Studios. I'm interested in the potential of soil as a collaborator. In this series, we'll be exploring soil's vital role in our lives through the work of the artists who are close to it, in response to the exhibition here at Somerset House called Soil, The World at Our Feet.
Soil is the foundation of everything.
There's this layer in which this stuff exists, which is so thin.
It is a witness because it has seen so much.
Our ancestors are there too.
Soil, of course, is the essence.
The creative output is spontaneous. You just don't know when it's gonna just bubble up.
Across 3 episodes, we'll trace the life cycle through soil. From the ways the soil is vital for the beginnings of all life, to its importance as a creative material, before ending with decay and rebirth, and the radical potential of soil as a regenerating force. In this first episode, we're going to explore beginnings, and we start with a personal one for me. So, we are standing in my garden in Essie, London. I grow vegetables and herbs. There's a tea bed as well as 2 garden beds for greens. And at the back is where I grow the larger vegetables, corn, squashes and pumpkins. I didn't have any space to grow or touch the ground when I grew up in an estate in London. And it wasn't until I was an adult, which I wanted to learn more about the world around me, especially during the pandemic, and to get outside and feel connected in a place of dissociation with this world. So I moved to South London, where I was able to luckily get this quite large piece of garden that I share with the people I live with. Growing for me was like a new beginning. The great thing about having so many different types of artists looking at soil is that our different positions, our different viewpoints, cultures, practices will offer that rich perspective that is necessary to understand a really multifaceted, multitonal, many-shaded entity like soil.
Artists are the ones that can tell the story and can tell a story of what's happening in society, and to see soil on the canvas and in people's minds is incredibly exciting. I'm Nicole Masters. I'm an agroecologist. I'm a Kiwi living in Montana, bringing more creativity and artistry to science is making the perfect baby. We are connecting not just from the analytical mind that's been driving systems for so long, but also from the heart and the soul and the gut. The beauty of artistry is to shine that light for people to just see the world differently.
I come from a family that have immigrated here after a volcanic eruption in Montserrat in the Caribbean. And I wanted to understand this place, which we have now made home. Land is often not a thing that maybe you would connect London to, land, right? But there is something underneath us always.
So in 2019, I made this project called Absorption, which was about gathering all the products, the waste products of industrial society, and then recombining them into soil, which is the building block of new landscapes.
Asad Raza is an artist based in Berlin. He gets us thinking about what it might mean to create new soil from scratch.
I started thinking about what would it mean to construct new land. You know, what you need if you're going to try to make new land is soil, because that's the building block. And it just so happened that there was a very well-known and prominent soil scientist at the University of Sydney named Alex McBratney. And I went to him and I said, could we make artificial soil out of ingredients that you can find around Sydney? I mean, constructed, as opposed to just dug up out of the ground.
Now, we're going to want about a third of a liter, so about 300 milliliters bentonite clay. Then you follow that up with about 300 milliliters of your sand, as you'll recall. Mine has some leaves in it, and that's fine.
There's all this detail to it, which kind of reminds me of the world of precision baking.
So I have here some old vegetables that have been ground up in my blender, and we're going to add that.
It was a sort of Anthropocene soil or something like that that we were making, and I started calling it neo-soil.
Snip a little bit of hair. You can snip some from anyone. Okay, maybe not. And now you mix it all together.
Composed of animate stardust, congregated here, absorbed in this.
And there you have it. You've made an inorganic and organic medium that combines the living and the non-living. So I hope you enjoyed making your own soil.
We fill an entire museum or gallery and all the rooms with it. And when visitors come, they walk on it, and then we give it to them. And they can take some home. They can even come with a truck and take like a ton home if they have a big garden. I had noticed already having a large museum full of soil is very stimulating to people's senses, to children, to dogs, and that a lot of people would have nostalgic or emotional experiences based on having grown up in a particular kind of landscape. And during the time when we did it in Berlin, I saw that exactly the same thing happened there. It's a material that everyone has a relationship to and has some kind of, you know, emotional response to often. It takes you into a more of a geological place. But at the same time, and that's what's interesting about soil, it's not simply a geological material, it's a biological material. So it's taking you somehow into the history of the planet as a living thing.
What are the beginnings of soil itself, and therefore all life on Earth?
If we had a time machine and we could go back like 420 million years ago or longer, what we would have found is that the planet was covered in sand, silt, and clay, a moonscape or Mars. What has occurred over the last 420 million years is this intimate relationship between plants and microbiology, and in particular fungi, that started to tap into the power of the sun and release organic materials and begin this whole aggregation and building blocks of what we would now see as soil.
When I first started working in farming, I actually was very disinterested in soil.
Abby Rose is a farmer and soil health advocate living between London and Chile.
For years, I just saw it as dirt. Like, it was muddy, and it was kind of an inconvenience, if anything. Or it was just a medium that plants sort of, it almost held plants up. I started digging holes, essentially. Or I had this moment, really, where I dug a hole, and I started to learn that actually the soil is alive. In one handful of soil, there's more living organisms than there are people on the planet. And to, like, conceive of that in my mind, it kind of took a little while to sink in. Not only is soil alive, it's teeming with life. fungal pathways that go miles. Trees can communicate. They can know that disease is coming from like 2 miles away because of these fungal pathways that are stretching across under the ground. And to me, then that's why it's amazing. It's because it's alive.
I like the analogy of you're standing on the edge of a cliff in a cave, shining a flashlight into the darkness. There's been some questions that have been taboo to ask about soil, like this idea that actually there is communication happening, that there's a language in soil, that microbiology are communicating to plants and animals and to us, but we don't yet have the technology in order to be able to listen.
What does an art practice look like outside in the earth rather than in a kind of vision of the studio? You just learn things by having your hand in the soil. You learn things by hand. It was also really formative in me understanding some of the like other forms of Black cultural practice that aren't maybe entertainment. So this idea that Caribbean growers are passing on a form of knowledge in the form of how to grow vegetables. It's the idea that there's a relationship to the ground, to the soil, and the way that we exist in this world. I've been trying to listen and develop that as part of my art practice. When you bend your ear close to it, you can hear a kind of rumble, vibration happening underneath. A slither, a shake. In my most recent work, I've been working with the soil. My work is invested in the mobilizing potential of sound, listening to the soil itself, and writing a kind of phonetic response from what I'm hearing. I'm embedding lots of different types of microphone into my garden, around 6 inches into the soil, and hearing what I get back. The critters, the worms that move through, eventually start to join, and I get to take those recordings and convert them into language. It's a part of my practice where I'm trying to find language that isn't the words that we already have, using the alphabet in a way that very much responds to what we are actually hearing in an onomatopoeic, sonic way. Influenced by experimental avant-garde poetry, the slither getting converted into S, Z's, C's, T's, H's creates a really thick word and choreography for the mouth to try and replicate what is happening beneath the soil. The soil as a composition, if you think musically, sonically, it's an orchestra. It has many different instruments happening in within it. It's not one note, it's many, and it has its own song. One of my favourite things that has ever been written. Maybe it's something that I kind of almost heard it in passing, was that we don't know what the energy is that makes a seed become. Once you have the cycle of growing, you also see your plants turn back into wanting to become seed and grow again. But it's also lovely because over that time of the plant being in your garden, it's got to know through the soil, through its roots, and through the environment, it's learned some lessons, and it's going to put those lessons back into the seed. So they are such depositories of information and knowledge. They carry, just like the soil, time and the build-up of time and adaptation within them, which is also just so cool. I guess I understood it in the abstract before, this idea of the cycles of nature but I know it for myself now. And it's something I'm really taking on in kind of more spiritual practice now, even thinking about the ways in which, if the earth is the thing which is my primary tutor and it's kind of the thing that I've come from, maybe the lessons I'm seeing of, you know, having to protect the young, right? This idea of the seedlings needing you to really defend them. And as somebody who's a teacher, it's a really important thing to think about, making sure that you're creating space in which you kind of defend people's agency and freedom to think and to be in conversation. When you're getting to know a plant, I really like to say, but do you know it by seed? It's tiny beginning. These tiny things hold so much potential. Now we hear from an artist who is thinking about this potential. We grow flowers in our gardens. They emerge from soil and are nourished by it. And then they become part of our culture.
Hello, my name is F. Tanyi. I am a multidisciplinary artist based in Montreal, Jojaki. I think it was the first year of the pandemic, maybe. We went on this island called El Perú. I kind of came across like these wild roses, and obviously they have 5 petals and they're quite different from the commercial ones. I was like, it's so strange. They really look like roses. And like, there's these like little pricks, but like, clearly they aren't. And it just shocked me so much. Like, for me, it was such an example of how far removed sometimes. Like, I grew up in a city, and whether it's food or flowers or like anything that kind of comes from nature, sometimes we are so far removed from like its origin or its source. It was funny to me because I always thought I hated roses. But then seeing, yeah, there's just all these like wild one, climbing rose, garden rose, like there's just old rose, new rose, like there's just so much. The exhibition, you'll see this video that's played over a background of a wallpaper of roses taken from illustrations from Josephine Bonaparte's garden, which was one of the first big rose collection, which kind of points to the beginning of the rose craze in the Western world. It's kind of a essay form video. The broad topic's the rose, but the rose is really an excuse to look at or desire to possess nature, control it, enhance it, and commercialize it.
Eva's work is like a collage. Information and images of roses all coming at you. It's a fascinating cacophony that really makes us think about these common flowers in a new way.
I think that one thing that people have tied for to have made links between, I think, the garden as a whole and then roses and flowers as well, in general, with femininity or womanhood, is because it's been pacified and kind of tied to the domestic world. So I think for me, there was that criticism of wanting almost to give back agency to women, but also to nature. And like, what does it mean when we try to confine women and we try to confine nature as well? And so a garden can be a sanctuary, can be a place of solace, but it's also a place where there's an amount of coercion that happens and control. One aspect was, for me, making art to also engage with this history of men kind of portraying women and having control over, like, let's say, female nudes, or women artists being able to paint still lives and flowers because that was deemed like an appropriate topic. It's not political. You're not actually participating in any debate or conversation. That is the realm of men. So for me to engage today in 2024 as racialized women in the arts, how do I want to inscribe myself or part from that tradition, let's say? What is an English rose? It's a like fair-skinned women, agreeable, you know, it's kind of tied to certain notions that are tied in I think, to like certain Western beauty standards that are very much defined by whiteness. In contrast, thinking about the people who often have to actually labor to grow these roses are often in the global South. And just thinking about the relationship to the body as it relates to nature. It has become an object. It's not just something that grows in the wild. It's something that we've kind of manufactured, right? And we've developed like technologies around it and a billion-dollar industry. And so I think we need to think about what is the impact of those desires we have into like, you know, certain communities in African countries who get drained of water because the water is used for the greenhouses to grow roses. That what does it mean for us to be able to go to Tesco and buy a 1 pound flower? To this day, every time I buy flowers, I can't resist it. Like, I can't resist buying flowers for myself. But yeah, I'm always confronted with those same questions. And I don't think there's like an easy answer or easy solution. I think it's a big process of like unlearning. And there's something very humbling in seeing that actually, like, yeah, this goes back to like thousands of years ago when there's so many cultures that have been caring for roses and tending to gardens, and that there's so much possibilities. There's been different trends and there's been different approaches, and these are always shifting. And so we're not like, in a sense, we're not doomed, I hope. Like, I think that looking at the garden and looking at our relationship with flowers allows to imagine different relationships and different futures. And so there's something optimistic, I think, in there for me.
What I really hear when I listen to Ev is that kind of monologue that I have when I'm gardening, actually, which is like, there are so many questions here. I have so many questions about what I'm looking at, what I'm growing, how it came to be, what it means. And she really shines a light on those questions. I think sometimes as gardeners, some people want to keep politics out of the garden, but the garden is an inherently political space. It's right to ask these questions sometimes about, can we control nature in this way? Should we? What does it do to manipulate a flower in all these ways for our benefit? And a rose is a really good case study. What choices do we want to make for our future? And those choices that we make are going to be reflective on the soil. Thinking ahead, but also thinking about what we're going to do in the present. You really want to think about the choices that we're going to make in this very moment. It's almost like with soil, every moment is a new beginning. A new material is added to the soil to become soil. A new experience can be had. It's something that changes. The intensity of the smell might meet somebody between the eyes and cause a tear. It just really shows the large potential for difference and different experiences and perspectives of soil.
I'm using the gallery like a kind of a depot where people can come and get some and go. We keep adding more ingredients and mixing it. It's a team of people I call cultivators doing this, and that just keeps happening until they take it all away at the end of the show. We're adding, you know, cacao husks from a local chocolate factory today, and you smell that and you take some home with you. And so I don't think
the cacao husk anecdote really struck me. It really speaks to the fact that we have moments with soil. Soil is a time-based material, right? If soil is an art material, it might not be sculpture, it might be performance. It's the liveliness by which Asad describes soil that really strikes me. It's the performativity, the kinetic, the sensorial, the emotional aspect, the experiential aspect of soil.
I did get asked one time if we could display it in a vitrine, because the museum director was very nervous about sanitary conditions and bacteria. And I was like, bacteria? You're worried about bacteria? Like, bacteria are everywhere always. You can't be worried about bacteria. But in any case, and I said, we can't, because that wouldn't be this piece. This piece is about making artificial soil, making neo-soil, spreading it out. And when you see the piece, you're already walking on it. You have to be on the soil. That would also be a difference between this piece and, you know, Walter de Maria's Earth Room, which is a famous land art piece where he filled a Soho gallery with soil that he dug up from a farm outside Pennsylvania. I guess, number one, his soil is already made. It's soil that existed already that he brought over. But secondly, you see it from behind a glass wall. You can't get to it. You can't touch it. And of course, there's a frisson to that, too. There's a different frisson to that when you can't engage with something that you wish you could engage with, that produces a thwarted desire or something. But in the case of my piece, you have to be able to walk on it. You have to be able to give it to the visitors. And those are non-negotiable. So I do think that what the effect of encasing it into the museum or the gallery can be is it puts renewed or increased attention to it. Because I see the museum and the gallery as a kind of like a microscope or a telescope where whatever you put in there, people pay attention to, right? It's a place to channel people's attention to things that our society deems relevant in some way or another. For most of history, soil is just something that was there. It was in art terms, it was a ready-made. You just went and got it and used it. A lot of people who I wouldn't have expected are sort of dismiss it. You know, it's not a real material because it's not human. It's not fully man-made, you know. It's not fully under our control. I mean, marble is not man-made, but it's much easier to control it because you can carve it and then it stays like that. But soil, if you just leave it alone, 2 days later you come back, you're going to have a garden, you know. You'll have stuff growing out of it. That's not under your control.
Ideas of control are really being questioned, that its agency is really apparent. I'm not making the soil, it's making itself, and I am just a witness, and bearing witness to what we have around us.
We're really looking at only 1/32nd of the entire surface of the planet. We cut an apple into those pieces, and then the topsoil layer really is that top 6 inches.
I think there's a renewed and increasing interest in these things that's not going to go away because of all of the devastating, you know, impacts on climate, on ecosystems, on living systems, on the earth all around us. I think with soil, you have to take into account that it's an issue that will never be not important for human beings. And yet it's maybe especially important with the conditions that we have right now, globally and ecologically. But we are also very, very good at forgetting about what's kind of crucial and important, you know. So the soil question kind of in a way needs to keep being raised. Just like certain spiritual questions need to keep being raised over and over, but maybe in a new way for each generation.
Luckily, again, with art, I think in a sense, we have cycles. Art has moved away in some ways in the kind of technological aspects to the soil. But then so many of those artists always return to a subject. And hopefully that lens will help us understand more and be even more connected in the ways that we should be living and inhabiting this planet that needs us to listen to it ever more closely. I'm Shanice Aretha. This episode is produced by Joe Barrett. The series is produced by Joe Barrett and Alana Chance for Somerset House. The exec producers are Alana Chance and Eleanor Scott. Original music is by Andrew Peckler. In the next episode, we'll be looking at more of the endless possibilities soil offers us as a creative material. From the earliest forms of making in clay, to the ways in which soil is deeply entangled in the politics of empire and ownership. How can soil point to different notions of time?
Clay, as a material, it gets us so close to this time that is so far away.
How does soil, as an archive, bear witness to our difficult histories?
The soil, I think, as a tomb, as a witness, as an archive. I feel it crunching beneath my feet. I'm also looking at it for clues to understand the site.
Soil, the world at our feet, will be on at Somerset House until the 13th of April, 2025.